welcome Hemming back to the Brainiac-a-thon podding way cast. This is your Captain Ander Lewis speaking. We are talking about The Red and the Black, Book 2, Chapter 18. Unhealthy relationship? Question mark? I think yes. Swims to the mumfish. He said, these two are batshit crazy. That is all. Laura Weistich says, okay, I don't feel bad for Matilda anymore. These mind games they're both playing are crazy. This is the schmoop summary for Chapter 18. I found it really amusing. It's called Terrible Times. Quite fitting. Matilda thinks back on how Julian almost murdered her in the library and figures that, for some reason, this gesture makes him truly worthy of her. She walks up to Julian the next day and asks him to accompany her into the garden. Once they're alone, she starts talking to him about the state of her heart. She makes sure to talk as much as possible about all the other young men in her life, and this tortures Julian. Finally, Julian tells her that he loves her and that he'll do anything for her. This destroys Matilda's interest in him, since she only wanted him in the first place because he paid no attention to her. Now that he's grovelling at her feet, she finds him repulsive. They're just doing the same thing back and forth. It's the hard to get. Like, whichever one, if you show interest, you're unattractive. If you seem aloof or, like, boast about the other people you've been with or seem, you know, unavailable, uninterested, then you're more attractive. And they're just going back and forth in this tug of war of who can be least attractive to the other. Sorry, at least attracted to the other, which makes them more attractive. And then as soon as they start to seem attracted to them, they become less. And they're never going to meet in this middle ground because as soon as you're into me, I'm not into you. But as soon as you turn your back, I come crawling back until you turn around again. And then I go, oh, you are into it? I'm out of here. And they're just doing this on a loop. On a loop. It's quite amusing and ridiculous. Let's read chapter 19 and move on with our lives, shall we? Oh, it starts with a Shakespeare quote. The opera Bouffe. Oh, how this spring of love reassembleth the certain glory of an April day, which now shows all the beauty of the sun, and by a cloud takes all away. Billy Shakes. That's old Billy S. Pier. Okay. Taken up with the future and the unusual part she hoped to play in it, Matilda soon began to look back with regret on the dry, metaphysical discussions she had had so often with Julian. When weary of such lofty thoughts, she sometimes regretted also the moments of happiness she shared with him. These latter memories were not free from remorse, and at certain times she was overwhelmed by this. But if one does have a moment of weakness, she said to herself, it is due to the dignity of a girl like me to fail in her duty only for a man of merit. It cannot be said that his handsome moustaches seduced me or his grace on a horse, but rather his profound discussions of the future that awaits France. This, his ideas about the parallel that the events which soon may sweep over us could have with the revolution in England in 1688. I may have been seduced, she retorted to her remorse. I am only a feeble woman, but at least I have not been led astray by superficial charms like a doll. If there is a revolution, why shouldn't Julian Sorel play the part of Roland and I that of Madame Roland? I'd much prefer her role to that of Madame de Stael. In our century, immoral goings-on will be a hindrance. Certainly no one will be able to reproach me with a second attack of weakness. I would die of shame. It must be confessed that Matilda's reflections were not always so serious as the thoughts we here transcribe. She would gaze at Julian and discover a graceful charm in his slightest actions. Undoubtedly, she said to herself, I have succeeded in extirpating there even the slightest idea that he possesses any rights. The look of suffering and deep passion with which the poor fellow told me that he loves me about a week ago demonstrates that clearly enough. It must be admitted that it was very odd of me to be so annoyed at his saying something that burned with such respect, such passion, aren't I his wife? It was a very natural thing to say, and it must be admitted that it was that he was being very amiable. Julian was still able to love me after all those endless conversations in which I spoke to him exclusively, and I admit with great cruelty of the little romantic inclinations that the boring life I lead induced me to have for the society men of whom he is so jealous. Ah, if only he knew how little danger they posed to me, how unsubstantial they seem compared to him, all mere reproductions of one another. While making these reflections, Matilda was randomly sketching with her pencil on a page in her album. One of the profiles she had just finished amazed her, delighted her. It captured Julian in the most striking way. This is the voice of heaven. Here is a miracle of love. She cried out to herself with rapture. I have made his portrait without meaning to. She dashed back to her room, shut herself in, and applied herself in earnest, trying seriously to do a portrait of Julian, but without success. The profile sketched at random remained the best likeness. Matilda was delighted with this. She saw in it plain proof of a grand passion. She did not relinquish her album until very late, when the Marquise had her called to go to the Italian opera. Then she had only one aim, to catch a sight of Julian so that she could arrange for her mother to get him to accompany them. He did not appear. The ladies had only commonplace people in their box. All through the first act of the opera, Matilda dreamed in great gusts of passion of the man she loved. But in the second, a certain formulation of the subject of loving sung, it must be admitted, to a melody worthy of Cimarosa, pierced her heart. The heroine of the opera sung, I must punish myself for my excess of love. Too much do I love him. The moment she heard this divine cantilena, all else in the world vanished for Matilda. Someone spoke to her. She did not reply. Her mother scolded her. Hardly could she return her look. Her ecstasy reached a plane of exaltation and passion comparable to the most violent bouts of emotion Julian had suffered on her behalf during the last fortnight. The cantilena, full of marvellous grace, in which was set the sentiment that seemed so strikingly applicable to her own situation, held her attention. Every moment she was not thinking directly about Julian. Thanks to her love of music, she became that evening, as Madame de Renal always was when thinking of Julian. Love generated in the mind is doubtless more intelligent than true love, but it has only flashes of enthusiasm. It is too conscious of itself. It constantly appraises itself, far from scattering the thoughts. It is constructed by the power of thought alone. On returning to the house, Matilda pretended, in spite of all that Madame de la Mole might say, to have fewer and spent part of the night replaying the cantilena over and over again on her piano. She sung the words of the famous air that had so struck her. Devo punirimo, devo punirimi, si troppo anamai, etc. The result of this night of madness was that she became convinced that she had succeeded in conquering her love. This page will do damage to its unfortunate author in more ways than one. Frigid souls will accuse him of impropriety, but he does no injury to those young women who shine in the Paris salons now by supposing that any one of them is susceptible to the wild impulses of that degrade Matilda's character. This character is completely imaginary, and what's more, is imagined quite apart from those social customs that will assure the civilization of the 19th century so distinguished a place amongst the ages. It certainly was not prudence that was lacking in the young girls who ornamented this winter's ball. Oh, wow, that's a long bracket. I was looking for the end of this bracket. All this is in brackets, by the way. Indeed, I don't think one can accuse them of being a great deal too scornful of the brilliant fortune, horses, fine estates, and all the things that assure the agreeable position in the world. Far from all these advantages, generating nothing but boredom, they are, in general, the objects of a most constant desire, and if there does exist a passion in those hearts, it is for them. Nor is it any longer love that directs the careers of reasonably talented young men like Julian. These attach themselves with bands of steel to some coterie, and when that coterie prevails, all society's good things are rained upon them. This is bad news for the educated man who is not a member of any coterie. People who censure him, even for the small and uncertain success he has, and superior virtues will triumph as they rob him. Ah, sir, a novel is a mirror travelling down the road. Sometimes it reflects the blue of the heavens to the eye, sometimes the mud of the filth puddles on the road. And he who carries the mirror in his pack will be blamed for being immoral. His mirror shows the filth, and you blame the mirror. Much better blame the high road where the puddles are, and better still the inspector of roads who lets the water gather and the muddy puddles collect. Now that it is clearly agreed that Matilda's character is impossible in our age, which is no less prudent than it is virtuous, I am not so scared of giving offence when I continue with the tale of this amiable young woman's follies. All day, next day, she was on the watch for opportunities to assure herself that she had indeed triumphed over her mad passion. Her chief aim, was to be as unpleasant as she could to Julian, but none of his movements escaped her. Julian was too unhappy and above all too agitated to detect so complicated an evolution of passion, and still less could he divine in it all that might be favourable to him. He was its victim. His misery had perhaps never been so extreme. His actions were so little under the direction of his intellect that if some disillusioned philosopher said to him, "Try to take a swift advantage of dispositions that could be favourable to you in this kind of mentally generated love, the kind one sees in Paris, the mode of behaviour doesn't remain constant for more than 2 days at a time," he wouldn't have understood him. But even so, worked up as he was, Julian retained his honour. His prime duty was discretion, and he understood that to ask advice, to tell his sufferings to the first comer, would have been a relief comparable to that of some poor fellow crossing a burning desert to whom heaven grants a drop of cold water. He saw that danger. He was afraid that he might respond to an inquisitive questioner with a flood of tears. He shut himself up in his room. He gazed at Matilda walking for a long time in the garden. When at last she had left it, he came down. He went up to a rose bush from which she had plucked a flower. The night was overcast, and he could give way to his misery freely without fear of being seen. It was quite obvious to him that Mademoiselle de la Mole loved one of those young officers with whom she had just been talking so gaily. Once she had loved him, but then she had realized how little merit he had. "And truly I do have so little," Julian said to himself with complete conviction. "All in all, I am a pretty dull creature, very common, extremely tedious to others, and pretty intolerable to myself." He was mortally weary of all his good qualities, of all the things he had eagerly loved, and in this state of inverted imagination, he undertook to elevate existence through his imagination. This is the mistake of a superior man. Several times the idea of suicide occurred to him. It was a most attractive image of a sweet relief. It was the glass of water offered to the wretch dying of thirst and heat in the desert. "My death would increase the contempt she feels for me," he cried. "What a memory I will leave behind me. The only resource left to a human being fallen into the last abyss of wretchedness is courage." Julian had not enough imaginative fire remaining to tell himself, "You must dare," but as he looked past the shutters at the window of Matilda's room, he saw that she was putting out her light. He pictured this charming room, which he had seen, alas, but once in his life. His imagination could go no further. 1 o'clock sounded. There was but an instant between hearing the stroke of the clock and saying, "I'm going up the ladder." This was his flash of inspiration. Excellent reasons crowded after. "Could I be more miserable?" he cried. He hurried to the ladder. The gardener had chained up. With the help of the hammer of one of his pistols, he snapped. Julian fired, now by superhuman strength, twisted one of the links that held the ladder. In a few moments he had it under control and put it up against Matilda's window. "She will be angry. She will heap scorn on me. What does it matter? I'll give her a kiss, a final kiss. I'll go up to my room and kill myself. My lips will touch her cheek before I die." He flew up the ladder. He rapped on the shutter. After a few moments, Matilda heard him. She tried to open the shutter, but the ladder stopped her. Julian grabbed the iron hook meant to keep the shutter open and, risking pitching down 1,000 times, gave a violent heft to the ladder, which moved it a little. Matilda could open the shutter. He threw himself inside, more dead than alive. "So it's you, dear one," she said, throwing herself into his arms. I think we'll stop there for today. Do a little halfy. There's not much left of the chapter, only, 3.5 pages. But there is a break in the text there, so it might be a good spot to break. And also there's a few little bits about that chapter that I wanted to put in the discussion thread already. So I think before we see what happens now between them, let's go back and discuss the first one. It's kind of like 2/3 of this chapter. All right. Thank you very much for listening. Do go to the discussion thread. Interesting discussion happening today, I assure you. And I'll see you tomorrow.